This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Ladd Everett. He is with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about violence, gun violence in the United States. I mean, we have not only lots of guns, I think 300 million guns owned by citizens. We also have a huge military. We have police that are killing a lot of people with guns. And people killing not only each other but themselves. I mean, it's a huge problem, and we tend not to contextualize it in the context of the rest of the world. Let's look at the 21st century. Like, since the year 2000, Americans who have been killed by guns, what do the numbers look like, and how many of those numbers are children?
Well, wow, that's, I mean, you're basically talking about roughly 30,000 people every year. And in terms of the number of children, you're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 a day during that time period. So, you know, we're talking about a lot of carnage. And like you said, it's not just the homicide, it's also the suicides, which outnumber the homicides every year, and also accidental deaths. So it's a massive problem.
And so suicides, homicides, accidents with guns that are often legally owned by citizens, not always. How does this compare to other countries?
Well, I mean, if you want to find gun death rates that are comparable to ours, typically you're looking at, either nations that have a great deal of political instability or where there is, a great deal of political violence. If you compare us to other high-income nations, other democracies or free nations, typically we're going to have a far higher gun death rate. And in many cases, a higher overall homicide rate. So it's not that the guns themselves are causing all the death and injury. It's that when someone attempts a suicide or when there is an attempted crime, it is far more likely to be lethal if a firearm is involved.
Right. So if we look at the reality that our rate of death by gun is comparable to those of highly politically unstable countries. Like, look, what countries are we talking about?
We're talking about countries, either in Africa or Latin America or somewhere, where there is not a, let's say, strong central government that is able to control violence. Again, if you compare this to other democracies, we do not compare favorably. Other countries basically where there is, a strong central government and law and order in society in general. If people want to look at the stats in detail, there's a great resource online called the Gun Policy website. It's gunpolicy.org, and it allows you to do comparative analysis of the U.S. with really all other countries for gun death rates, homicide rates, all that kind of thing.
Why are we so different than other democracies? Talk about both our actual laws and also our beliefs and traditions.
Well, in terms of the laws, I mean, the United States has really arguably the weakest gun laws of any civilized country in the world. It's not a situation in this country where you would need a background check in most cases to buy a gun. Most states allow some types of private firearm sales where there is no background check or record of sale required. So that's an immediate loophole through which people who are prohibited parties, like convicted felons, can move to buy guns without any oversight whatsoever. And then, quite frankly, even when you do undergo a background check and buy a gun, the checks are not very stringent. Many of our mass shooters in this country legally buy guns and pass those checks despite substantial history of violence or the fact that they're dangerously mentally ill. So it's not a very high hurdle. We're just not a nation that does very much to stop violent people from buying guns. In our system has always been predicated on making the sale. Our background check system is an instant computer check system. There's no background investigation there. There's no calls to local law enforcement to make sure we got it right. It's always been predicated on making the sale. So, It has to do with priorities, and unfortunately, that those have been the priorities of our lawmakers to date. As for the traditions in this country and how they affect it, firearms ownership certainly is part of the American tradition, and also obviously so is the skepticism of government. That's also part of the American strain. And I think in the last 4 to 5 decades, unfortunately, the conservative movement in this country has done a good job of convincing people, number one, that the United States government is their enemy, which is unfortunate. And then number two, that the ownership of privately held firearms is the only thing securing their freedoms in this country. That's a dangerous concept, but unfortunately, a lot of people in this country have bought it, and it's made reform a lot tougher.
There's more than one interpretation of the Second Amendment. A lot of Americans believe the Second Amendment is about arming citizens to oppose tyrannical government. What is your understanding of the Second Amendment?
Well, the Bill of Rights, of course, comes after the Constitution, after the ratification of the Constitution. And essentially what the Bill of Rights was, it was James Madison, the Federalist, his basically offer to anti-Federalists at that time who were scared about the Constitution for several reasons, where he basically reached out to them and said, listen, guys, if you will help me ratify the Constitution at the state level, I promise I will quickly get back to work once it's ratified and establish this Bill of Rights that addresses a whole number of concerns that you had with the Constitution, including certain provisions, new provisions for individual rights, states' rights, that will ameliorate some of your concerns here. And he held to that agreement. And the things that scared anti-Federalists and states' rights actors in the Constitution in terms of the right to keep and bear arms were the fact that in Article 1, Section 8, it gave the federal Congress the ability to arm the state's militia, organize, train, and equip that militia. And then also that the Constitution gave the president, the newly designed president of the United States, the ability to call state militia outside their own borders and into more national-level conflicts. And anti-Federalists, individuals who are more skeptical of federal government power or government power in general, made the legitimate argument at the time that if you've given our federal Congress the ability to arm our state militia, what would prevent them from just withholding arms and disarming us? And the Second Amendment, it was Madison's attempt to create the system by which moving forward, individuals serving in the militia would do so with their own privately held firearms. That because, as the language of the amendment reads, because militia at that time were necessary to the security of a free state, we had no police forces at the time, the militia fought in our foreign wars, they were integral to internal and external security, that it would be privately held firearms that would be supplying the militia from now on. So there would be no dependence on the federal government, particularly should it become at some point oppressive. That was the ideal. In practice, it didn't quite work out that way. The states could not adequately arm the militia and very often had to call on the federal government to help them with that task. And as we know, I think, according to the historical record, the militia weren't always the fighting force that we thought they would be. They were very often unreliable. And as time kind of moved on, moving into the 20th century, our standing army became larger. And in the 20th century, we get these statutes that now make it clear that the organized militia in this country is the National Guard. And the National Guard, of course, does not, ask people to go out and buy their AR-15 at a gun show and then go serve in Iraq. Today's National Guard, all those weapons are supplied by the federal government. They give you your gun when you sign up, and when you're done with your term of service, you return that weapon. You don't take that weapon home. So, a couple of things have changed diametrically since the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791. The first thing is that this overwhelming fear of a standing army, which really motivated the drafting of the Second Amendment, because that was the theory. The theory was, the federal government would expand its standing army and then become oppressive. Well, today we have, one of the largest, most powerful militaries in the world, and no one fears them. When they do national opinion polls and ask Americans, what institution in this country do you trust the most? The military wins those polls almost all the time. So no one fears a standing army anymore. That motivation is kind of gone. And then today's militia is armed entirely by the federal government, not by privately held arms, and no one has raised any concerns about that. So I think the NRA, to a large extent, tries to make the Second Amendment out to be this insurrectionist directive that allows individuals to stockpile weapons and then basically confront the government with force of arms when they personally feel tyranny has occurred. But the truth is far different than that. It was really more Madison trying to strike a better balance in federalism to give the states the power they needed to be able to arm their militias without relying on the federal government. But as I explained, it just hasn't worked out that way.
So when you say militia, we're talking about groups like what would now be the National Guard, as you say, or would now be the Army, Navy, Air Force. We're not talking about insurrectionist groups like the people in Oregon or the other people who call themselves militias. Like what that kind of those people who are calling themselves militia, does that have anything to do with like the 18th century meaning of that term?
Not at all. Not at all. When we talk about militia in the modern day sense, federal statute defines both what the organized militia is, and that's the National Guard, and also it defines the unorganized militia, which theoretically is any American who's able to fight, essentially, who's physically capable, physically and mentally capable of serving the country in case of some eventuality in which their state would have to call them up for service. But the unorganized militia is never used in this country. No one, you know, you or I are never going to be called up to serve in the unorganized militia because, you know, we have a great all-volunteer military, you know, which includes our active duty forces as well as the Guard and Reserve. And it just hasn't been necessary. That, you know, they're highly trained. Many believe them to be the best military in the world. So there's just there's never been any reason to call the unorganized militia up to serve. Where you'd get a much more mixed bag in terms of level of training, level of competence, et cetera, et cetera. When we talk about the Bundy brothers and the folks, you know, occupying this federal refuge in Oregon, they're not the equivalent of the militia. What they are the equivalent of are early Americans like Daniel Shays, who believed that they had this type of right to basically take up arms and shut down government functions, again, when they personally believed our federal government was becoming oppressive. Again, the historical record's pretty clear here. Our founders did not take kindly to that idea. The Shays Rebellion was put down forcefully, obviously. And then years later, when the Whiskey Rebellion happened, again, you know, individual citizens upset about a federal tax, thinking they could take up their arms again and stop that. It was George Washington himself who rode out at the head of 13,000 actual militia members to stop them, to put them down. So that's really their equivalent. They do have an equivalent in history, but it's certainly not militia or anyone our founders would have taken kindly to.
That's very interesting. So the people in the ranchers in Oregon who have taken over the wildlife sanctuary are the equivalent of the 18th century insurgents. They think that they can oppose what they are calling a tyrannical, unfair government. Their power is in their guns. How do you understand the situation? First of all, what laws have they broken? And why is law enforcement sitting still and not doing anything? What's going on?
Well, that's a good question, right? Because a lot of this stems from the earlier crisis at the Bundy Ranch in Bunkerville, Nevada, where, you know, federal agents tried to seize Bundy's cattle, which they were fully in their rights to do. They've been trying to get, you know, payments from this guy for years and years for proper taxes for grazing taxes and whatnot. And the Bundy's folks pointed guns at them. He had, you know, his own makeshift, you know, group of insurrectionists there, and they pointed guns at Las Vegas Metro Police and Bureau of Land Management agents and got their way. The cattle were released and law enforcement vacated the area. And there's been really no enforcement against that group since. And unfortunately, that has signaled to other insurrectionists around the country that it's a free-for-all now, that basically if you're willing to take up your guns and threaten to kill the government or government officials, you can get your way. And I think that's very much the message that Bundy's sons got. And I think that's why they're occupying this refuge building, because they had a sense, well, the federal government let us go this far previously, and they'll let us go this far now. And that's held true so far. Why are the government allowing these guys to operate in this building and cut down fences and all this stuff? I have no idea. Everyone I talk to seems to be of the sense that they should have cut off their heat the very first night and prevented anyone from going in that building. So far, it seems like reporters are able to access the building freely. They're allowing the supporters of these guys to come in and bring food. I just don't understand it. You know, obviously, there's going to be caution there based on previous similar incidents like what happened at Waco in the 90s and Ruby Ridge. But at some point, you have to enforce the law, and our founders understood that. At some point, if you don't enforce the law, you end up with anarchy because you're going to have more guys like this. We're, you know, there's a lot of guns in this country. There's no shortage of guns for guys to be able to pick up and say, hey, I don't like this law or I don't like this court ruling. And, you know, if you don't change it, I'll kill you. I mean, that anybody could theoretically do that. So at some point, if they refuse to enforce the law, if they allow these guys to continue to do this, they're going to have a hell of a problem on their hands, a lot more than just one ranch and one refuge. Because like I said, there's no shortage of these guys out there, and they're all seeing the lack of government action. So I wish I had an answer for that. I wish I knew. But I can tell you that we're not happy, and also a coalition that we're now part of called the Ballots Not Bullets Coalition is also very unhappy to see this. We would like to see the law enforced.
It's really amazing to me that the law enforcement that we taxpayers are paying for isn't doing anything, and in addition to that, our tax dollars are going to provide heat and electricity to these guys. I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't make any sense why they don't cut off utilities and close the road.
It really doesn't, and I think you're raising the more important point, which is that, number one, this federal refuge center belongs to we the people, right? We pay the taxes on it. But you make a great point even with that, even the, you know, we pay taxes to support law enforcement. So for folks in those areas, or for those of us who pay to support federal agencies, what are we getting right now? It seems like they're getting everything they want by saying, hey, I'm going to shoot you. What have we gotten by being good citizens? And that's the whole problem here. It sends a terrible message. It sends a terrible message, not only to these guys who are all salivating now and thinking, hey, you know, what can I take up my gun and get my way on? But it also sends a message to folks like you and I or anyone else who pays taxes that, you know what, because you're not willing to threaten to kill someone, you're just not as important or you don't count as much. And I just really regret it. I really regret that they allowed them to get this thing started and didn't cut it off immediately. But then again, to be fair, I'm not out there. It's tough terrain out there, and maybe there's a plan in place to resolve it. I hope there is.
We're talking to Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Gun violence has been described as an epidemic. We had last week a public health doctor on the air who said that gun violence behaves like a virus in many ways, and it can really be seen as an epidemic. But we have in the United States basically a law that prohibits the Centers for Disease Control from using federal funding for gun violence research. What's going on?
Well, that's been a long debate in Congress. The NRA in the late 80s, early 1990s was angry about a series of reports that the CDC was putting out that indicated our problem with gun violence. There were some comparative reports they put out comparing our gun death rates with other industrialized nations, and then some other research that they issued. And the NRA immediately, the NRA in the early 90s began to move with their allies to block off the CDC from doing that type of research, and they worked with a former Arkansas congressman named Jay Dickey to get that done, and a rider was added to the CDC appropriations bill that basically prohibits them from using any federal funding to quote-unquote advocate for or promote gun control, which is very loose language, which essentially means if you are going to issue a report that indicates that gun laws would be effective, you can't do it and spend federal money doing it. And because the CDC was scared about their budget being further reduced moving forward if they continue to do that research, it basically shut off that pipeline entirely. And then in more recent years, the NRA moved to ban the NIH as well, National Institutes of Health, from doing that type of research, although NIH, under new guidance from the president, has been more aggressive in restarting that type of research, which is good. So the debate continues to this day, and there's been some very interesting commentary as of late from Jay Dickey, who's now retired and who now deeply regrets his role in getting that rider enacted. And Democrats did make a push this year to get that rider removed from the CDC appropriations bill and were unsuccessful. It seems to me that they will continue to wage that fight when the CDC appropriations bill comes up. But for now, unfortunately, it's still there. And the existing director of the CDC just refuses to even mention gun violence. I think they've got him so scared at this point that he won't even speak the two words, gun violence.
This does point to the whole question of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and its power at this point in history. It seems to be an accepted truth that their power lies in the fact that when they oppose a senator or representative, somebody who advocates gun safety or gun control, that person doesn't get reelected. Is that even true?
No, it's not true. The NRA has done a beautiful job of getting the media to focus on their victories and ignore their failures altogether. I mean, there have been some election cycles where they've just gotten trounced. 2012 is a good example, you know, where they almost lost across the board. There's also a gentleman named Paul Waldman who's done some really good research in this area. And he's basically found that the only type of candidate who gets a real boost from NRA support would be an incumbent Republican, an incumbent who already supports their agenda. But viewing other types of candidates, those who might oppose them, you know, he finds no benefit whatsoever from their endorsement and financial largesse. So it's very much a manufactured reputation by them because their record, when you look at it, is very mixed. But what you can say about the NRA in terms of the way they've been successful is they have been successful at creating a single-issue voter bloc, you know, a bunch of guys who go to the polls and the only thing on their minds when they vote is guns. You know, they will not vote for anyone who does not favor loose gun laws. It's been our challenge for decades now to create our own single-issue voter bloc, if you will, of people that will not vote for someone who supports loose gun laws. So I think we're getting a lot closer to that point. Since Newtown, the energy level on our side has increased significantly. And very often I'll ask our folks on Facebook, hey, are you now a single-issue voter for gun violence prevention? And many are indicating that, yes, indeed they are, that after this spate of horrors dating back to Newtown, they just can't take it anymore. So, you know, with the NRA, I think it's a mixed picture, but there is quite a bit to be said for grassroots energy, and we do live in an era, not of principled politics, but very often where our politicians are cowardly and simply want to move away from pressure just to avoid inconvenience. So it's incumbent on our side to be equally loud.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually looking at the numbers, and the NRA makes political campaign contributions of less than $1 million a year total, and they spend $3 million on lobbying, and that doesn't even hold a candle to, for example, insurance companies and the dairy industry and Wall Street and a lot of these other groups that spend far, far more on both political campaign contributions and lobbying. And what the NRA has on its side is a very politically engaged membership. They're the ones who are writing to their representatives. And on the other side, on the anti-gun violence side, groups like yours and their constituents, maybe there are just as many people, and certainly they're just as passionate, and yet they're not as active.
Right, that's the challenge. The challenge is kind of in two different areas. Number one, I'm not a fan of money in politics, and in fact, I would tell you that the great crusade of the 21st century needs to be getting money out of politics and restoring political equality. But we've been getting killed for decades because the NRA is the only party spending money in elections to influence politicians on the issue of guns. That picture is now a lot more balanced than it was. If you go back to before 2012, hell, we didn't even have any PACs that were active in election cycles on the gun issue. Now we do. We have former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Independence USA PAC, which is active for gun violence prevention, and also Gabby Gifford's new PAC through Americans for Responsible Solutions. And they're raising a lot of money. So come 2016, I think you're going to see the most balanced spending picture on the gun issue really in history in this country. The NRA will probably still be outspending us by some measure, but it'll be a far more balanced picture than it ever was. And finally, politicians are going to have to look both ways when they vote, not just towards the NRA, to see how much money and advertising they're bringing. And that's a good thing. But, you know, you brought up the other part of the equation, which is grassroots energy. You also have to have people constantly messaging with elected officials. And I think we've made humongous strides in that direction now since Newtown. You know, we now have chapters and activists, not our organization personally, but the movement now has chapters and activists in all 50 states who are making waves on a daily level, organizing events, reaching out to elected officials. So, you know, there's still some work to be done in this area. I'm not going to tell you that we've leveled the playing field totally, but man, has it changed considerably. And I think 2016 is going to be very telling. We are going to have to get our people out in that election and have them vote. And like I said, what I'm hoping to be reporting the day after the November election is this new phenomenon of single issue gun violence prevention voters. That's what we're aiming towards. We are asking people to consider that, to, you know, consider whether they really should vote for that candidate who is great on all their issues but terrible on guns. You know, should that person really get your vote? So that's what we're aiming at.
I have a question about the NRA, and that is, to what extent are they representing citizens who are pro-gun activists, and to what extent are they representing gun manufacturers who, I mean, have a really arguably more skin in this game than anybody else?
That's a good question. I mean, look, if you're talking about the guys that are running the ship, you know, which is essentially the NRA CEO, Wayne LaPierre, and this cabal under him that includes Ackerman McQueen executives. Ackerman McQueen is the PR firm that LaPierre brought in with him when he took control of the organization, that is responsible for a lot of their messaging on freedom and liberty and all this stuff. And they're basically the group that runs the organization. And for guys like that, you know, I don't really think they care too much about the average member in terms of what that person's needs really are. I mean, for a lot of these guys have limited income, and spending all their money on guns is just not good for them. Shooting is a very expensive hobby, not only in terms of buying guns, but ammo. Ammo is also very expensive. So for a lot of these guys, stockpiling guns is not a healthy decision to begin with. For many of them, it's extremely detrimental to their well-being, financial and otherwise. But I don't think that's really what LaPierre is geared on. LaPierre just, you know, those guys just want to sell more guns. And the NRA now is very intimately entwined with the gun industry. They have gun industry execs sitting right on their board of directors, guys like Ronnie Barrett and who else? Pete Brownell and others who run gun companies. And then the NRA also gets millions of dollars in direct corporate contributions from gun companies through what they call their Ring of Freedom program. So it's impossible to separate the two now. The gun industry, which is represented by the trade group, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, they don't do anything without the NRA's approval, period. So you can't detach the two. And the single common denominator in any lobbying the NRA does always seems to be aimed at either protecting existing gun sales or preventing any effort that would eliminate even a single gun sale, even if it's to someone who might be a domestic abuser or dangerously mentally ill or someone who's been convicted of multiple violent misdemeanor convictions, say, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, their focus always seems to be protecting existing gun sales to the fullest extent possible.
Let's talk for a moment about the Obama executive order on gun safety, which was announced last week. Go quickly over the main points of it, and what are the next steps? What has to happen for this to become effective?
Well, the executive orders were pretty broad in scope. Many of them were aimed at better enforcing existing laws on the books. And essentially the one that got the most media attention was this direction from the administration urging the ATF and U.S. attorneys to more aggressively go at individuals who are privately selling guns on a continual basis, but who have not gotten a proper license to deal in firearms and who are exempt from background check requirements. And a lot of how that pans out, that specific provision pans out, is going to depend on how, how aggressively the ATF and these attorneys go after private sellers. If they take the direction to heart and begin to aggressively prosecute these cases, I think we can expect to see a lot of good done. If it's more of a mixed response, we might not get the bump we want in terms of adequately monitoring private sales. But there are many other provisions going on here as well. There's a very interesting provision by which the president ordered the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security to begin researching smart gun technology, which could be a game changer, because the NRA has been very successful so far in kind of fighting off private entrepreneurs who've tried to bring the technology to the market. But if at some point DOD announces it has a working smart gun, it's going to be much harder for the NRA to claim that that DOD's very robust research arm got it wrong on that.
What's a smart gun?
Smart gun could be many different things. It could be anything from a gun that leave some kind of indicator on a crime scene to indicate who fired the gun. For example, micro-stamping technology, where every time a handgun is discharged, it would stamp the serial number of the gun onto ejected cartridge cases, so that if you find any spent brass at that crime scene, you're likely to identify the crime gun itself, which would be incredibly helpful. Almost never can we identify a crime gun based on evidence left at a scene right now. Or it could be what's being more popularly discussed now, which is guns that would prevent anyone but the user from firing the weapon, based on something like grip technology, recognizing a grip, or a code you might punch into the firearm, or a bracelet you might have to wear that has to be near the firearm for it to be discharged, things like that. So a smart gun, really could be anything, any type of technology that's used to make existing firearms either safer or to make gun crimes more easily solved. So it's really broad. It could be many different things.
Here in New Mexico, there are citizens groups that are trying to get laws passed that mirror the federal laws. And you were talking about stricter enforcement of federal laws and the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. How does this actually work? Like, to what extent do you need state laws if you have federal laws? Who's tasked with enforcing what sets of laws?
Well, like you suggest, there are federal laws and there are state laws, and I think people often forget how important it is to have state-level laws. And I'll give you one very prominent example. Since 1996, people who have been under active restraining orders for domestic violence, and also those convicted of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, are prohibited from buying and owning guns. But many states to this day still do not have a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence as a state crime listed in their statutes as a state crime that can be prosecuted. And that has been very harmful, because very rarely is someone who's committed a misdemeanor crime going to be prosecuted at any federal level. And the federal government really depends on the states to go after these folks. So it can be very important to have state-level laws that create the conditions where, you know, certain federal laws become effective, like the federal law prohibiting domestic abusers from buying guns. So, yeah, there is a great deal of joint responsibility there. And one of another one of the big issues is that ATF is just dramatically underfunded. They are one of the few federal agencies that for decades has really gotten no substantial increase in manpower or resources. And even for mundane tasks like the ATF would be charged with inspecting gun dealers, I mean, they're so undermanned that right now they can only do that, like, they can only inspect a gun dealer an average of once every 7 years right now based on their manpower and what they're able to do. So having state-level analogs for laws like this, or having state law enforcement willing to step up and engage in some of this enforcement, is critically important. Just because the ATF doesn't have the reach to do it, and whenever the ATF does get engaged in aggressive enforcement, there is inevitably a reaction from the NRA, which tries to attack their budget or prevent them from enacting a permanent director, things along those lines.
Well, that's a kind of amazing thing, is they haven't even had a director for years.
Well, they, for a short time, they did. They did get B. Todd Jones confirmed for a short time, but unfortunately, he has now moved on, and they're back to having an acting director, and there's no indication, at least at this point, that they'll have another permanent director anytime soon. But you're right. Prior to B. Todd Jones, it was, I think, a seven-year period where they had no permanent director. And, you know, when you're an agency lobbying for budget and other priorities, it's brutal not to have a confirmed official in place there. So, I mean, these things seem small, but, you know, over the decades, these are things that have added up and really mattered, because we don't have an agency that is protected by elected officials and given the resources it needs to go after gun criminals.
So let's go back to Obama's executive order and what it represents, what its future is, and what gun safety opponents are trying to do to undermine it. Do they have a way to do that? I mean, it seems like if you're going to order the government to start enforcing its own laws, it's a wise strategy.
Well, what Obama is trying to do is give an extra push and make this a priority for U.S. attorneys and for federal agencies, and that's a good idea. You know, it's a good idea, you know, because I think they've been largely intimidated throughout the years by the NRA, you know, which has been aggressive in attacking their budget priorities. But it really, you know, like I was saying, this, it really does need to be a joint responsibility. You know, another good example would be here in Virginia. Frequently from Republicans, we've heard calls to arrest individuals who lie when undergoing background checks, who lie on the form that you're required to fill out before the instant computer check is done. And here in Virginia, we have, you know, state police do a great job of going after those folks. They try to respond to every single case where a background check form is lied on. That's what I would call or describe as a really good model of enforcement. They have the state level police know the dealers, they know the locations, in many cases they know the people, and they're able to immediately respond. That's just not something we've given the ATF the ability to do. So those types of partnerships, I think, are critical and are going to be needed moving forward. But I think what Obama was trying to achieve more here was just to make sure that federal agencies understand the way he wants to see some of these laws enforced.
We're talking to Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Let's talk about the Democrat and Republican candidates and where they stand on gun violence. Can you kind of go through some of the top candidates?
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, with the Republican presidential candidates, there's not a lot of space between them on this. Most of them are very closely, you know, hewing to the NRA's agenda, are very skeptical of any reforms that might be, you know, promoted by either the administration or others. So, I don't think there's much need to go through that very specifically. They've all been, sadly, I think, pretty terrible on the issue. On the Democratic side, it's kind of a flip of that. You know, most of them have been very bold in championing gun violence prevention measures. There's a little bit of concern with the record of Bernie Sanders, who has historically much more of a mixed record voting on the issue. And the big issue now surrounding him is his previous vote for this gun industry immunity bill that he voted for in 2005, which he has not yet come around to supporting a full repeal of. But it's a very egregious measure. It was a corporate handout directly to the NRA, and it gave the gun industry protections for negligent behavior that are really enjoyed by no other industry in the country. And it's barred the courthouse doors on many victims and survivors of gun violence, among other Americans. So that's kind of the real open question with Bernie's record. We'd like, you know, I think certainly most groups like mine would like to see him support a full repeal of that law. And, you know, we'll see where he moves. So far, we've moved him a little bit. He's indicated now that he would support repealing some of the provisions in the law, but he continues to support, indicate that he supports other provisions in the law to this day. So there's some concerns there, but it's really like looking, you know, it's like a mirror image. The Republicans seem to be against even the most modest types of reforms. And on the other side, on the Democratic side, you now seem to have this dynamic where, in most cases, they're jumping over each other to kind of show who's going to be toughest against the NRA. So, you know, we love our group loves the dynamic that's shaping up on the Democratic side, not so happy with the dynamic on the Republican side, although I think once we get to general election debates, I think it's going to become much tougher on Republicans, and I would hope that you would see their candidate begin to moderate somewhat on the issues and possibly support at least some reform. But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. There's another issue that's related to all of this that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the issue of not only gun violence like mass shootings and murders and suicides and accidents, but also violence on the part of the police, who kill about 1,000 citizens a year. How do you think about police violence in the context of your work as the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence?
Well, I think that's a good question. And I think, you know, to be brutally honest, I think that's an area where our organizations have been too silent over the years. And I think that's, you know, that's obviously an issue where, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement has challenged us to be more vocal about shootings involving police. I think for us, for our organization, the turning point kind of came in Ferguson. And at that time, I believe we were the only gun violence prevention movement or organization, rather, who actually issued a public statement questioning whether the level of police response there was really necessary, you know, to deal with what largely was peaceful protest. But that's an issue that our movement really needs to speak about, because there is a significant amount of police-related shootings in this country, because there have been many egregious cases involving police abuse, and because there is a racial element to this that we can't ignore. Because, you know, when you're an organization like ours, not just on the gun issue, but any issue, and you're advocating for government reform, right? You want new laws. You're basically saying, you know, we want the government to do more in this area. Then it becomes very incumbent to make sure that it's good government, right? Because, you know, we need to be, I view our organization as needing to be champions of strong government, but also accountable government. And that's not what we've seen in certain cases like Ferguson and in certain other instances. So I think this dialogue with the Black Lives Matter movement and others has been very healthy for our movement. And I think we are becoming increasingly willing to speak out on this issue. You know, even though we might be sensitive to the relationships we enjoy with law enforcement, which are critical for enacting gun reforms, I think we now understand that we can't remain silent anymore, that we need to be stewards of good government. You know, if we're going to tell people on one hand we want the government to do more in this area, then we need to make sure that the enforcement in that area is fair and is equal, that there's political equality there, that there's equal justice there. So I think what you can expect to see from the gun violence prevention movement moving forward is a greater willingness to tackle these issues, and hopefully to be a part of the group that is promoting positive change in this area.
This is such a crazy country, and one of the things that I learned actually reading your website, which I didn't know before, is that there are actually gun violence deniers. There's, for example, a professor in Florida, I think, who is teaching and writing about his idea that Sandy Hook was a hoax and that no children died and things like that. Talk about that.
Yeah, that, you know, we just launched a campaign on that, actually a petition campaign, and the good news was that the gentleman you're speaking about who worked for Florida Atlantic University has been fired now, officially fired by the university. And he was an individual, you know, who was not only promoting these hoaxer notions about Sandy Hook, he was also engaged in acts of libel and harassment against some of the parents up there in a way that was really ugly. And to explain Sandy Hook truthers or individuals who develop hoaxes about, you know, around mass shootings claiming that they were government-sponsored events to advocate for gun control. I mean, to me, that is kind of the logical conclusion of this, how would you describe it, the fetishism or idolatry that exists around firearms in this country, where you have a group of men in this country that, you know, they own guns and they see them as political symbols that approach religious symbols, where their own personal identity is entirely entwined with firearms, and their sense of self-esteem as well, and where they see firearms as objects to convey not only personal power but political power through the idea of insurrectionism, which we discussed earlier. And to me, taking opposition to gun laws to this extent of just making up, you know, ridiculous conspiracy theories to the point where they're now it's not just, well, this mass shooting happens, but gun control won't work. Now it's taken to this extent of, well, this shooting didn't even happen. To me, it's just the logical extent of this spiritual sickness, which has led us to a point where many people in our country literally worship firearms. And that's not an exaggeration. They literally worship them and hold them in higher regard than the lives of human beings. To me, it's just a logical conclusion to that idea, and it's sickening. It's sickening and very disturbing. And my hope is that people will wake up and understand that the reason that this idea exists is because we have allowed many dangerous or deluded pro-gun ideas to foster so long without adequate opposition.
It's just about time to go, but I wanted to ask you before we go, how do you envision the United States with laws that both promote real gun safety and make room for the long-standing culture of people who use guns responsibly in this country? Like, what does that middle ground look like? It's not going to be like Germany where, you know, or Japan or places where nobody has guns. Pretty much, very few people, and getting them. It's not part of the daily life. Here it is. What would a safe, healthy country with guns here in the United States look like?
Well, I've been doing this for 15 years, and I've never, in 15 years, I've never spent a minute of working time advocating for any law that would have prevented, for example, hunting or sports shooting, recreational shooting, or that would have prevented someone from owning, you know, like a handgun or a shotgun in their home for self-defense. That's not what we do. To me, you know, the main things that our movement is focused on right now is really making sure that individuals who are dangerous or who have histories of violence are not allowed to either immediately or legally obtain firearms. You know, to me, if we were able to require a background check on every gun sale and then strengthen that background check system a little bit to make sure we were really catching everybody with a history of violence, you know, I might go on and do something else. It's not as far a leap as most folks think. In many cases, it's a lot of little things that have been allowed to linger, not only with the background checks system, but also, for example, you know, very rarely do we require people to report lost and stolen firearms. You know, it's things like that. It's things that probably most Americans assume that we do already and would be shocked to hear that we don't, but that are small things and that are critically important to basically preventing violent people from getting guns and then to being able to adequately investigate gun crimes when they occur.
Ladd Everett is with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.